You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. With this show, we are starting a two-part series on Palestinian mental health. Both shows are discussions with Palestinian doctors, public health specialists, and healthcare administrators that do amazing work with Palestinians in Palestine. I feel like I should say that this is a very timely topic given recent developments, but truthfully, it would be timely any time since the beginning of the 20th century, at least. Now, it is true, much of the outside world only recently noticed exactly how depraved Israel has been to Palestinians since October 7th, 2023. And documentation of that depravity going into this 10th month past the 300-day mark, reveals more depraved violent treatment of Palestinians as the genocide goes on and on. The speed and severity of the depravity has increased to previously unimaginable levels, and that is where we are early in August of 2024. But of course, it's a much longer story, and we will hear about how the entire history of Palestinian suffering from at least the Nakba forward has been an ongoing learning experience of managing the mental well-being of people who are experiencing unusual amounts of trauma in their lifetimes, as well as intergenerational trauma. Now, I use the word trauma, but even whether that is the right way to categorize the mental distress unique to the Palestinian experience is very much worth questioning. Today's show especially got me rethinking how I conceptualize mental health, trauma, and mental pathology. There is a lot we can learn from what the Palestinian situation has taught to Palestinians. So today I am really thrilled to be sharing the webinar entitled Occupied Minds, The Impact of Colonialism on Palestinian Mental Health. It was sponsored by the Harvard Graduate Student Union BDS Coalition on July 26, 2024. The one non-Palestinian voice you will hear asking questions in this webinar is Sarah from the HGSU BDS group. This was an online conversation with Samah Jabr, who is speaking from Jerusalem. Dr. Samah is a consulting psychiatrist and head of the mental health unit at the Palestinian Ministry of Mental Health. She is also so much more than that. She is an author and a health advocate. She is a truly great thinker on how to understand her people's colonization and their colonizers' impact on Palestinian mental health. The Harvard encampment in spring 2024 even had its own health and well-being treatment center that they named after her. A little bit farther into the show, you will also hear from Dr. Wi'am Hamouda. Dr. Hamouda is assistant professor at Harvard University's Institute of Community and Public Health. She specifically works on understanding how political and social transformations impact health, mental well-being, social systems, and population processes. And of course, her focus is Palestine. We have got a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go. One show note to give you before we start. You'll hear from Sarah first during the webinar. She'll be asking questions of Dr. Samah. You will hear Dr. Hamouda at about 6 minutes for the first time. She will often be addressing the same questions that Dr. Samah is addressing, and sometimes she will also be asking the questions. So with that, here is Occupied Minds.
I'd love to get us started with our first question. We often think of trauma or psychological suffering as a secondary effect of violence, resource deprivation, and human rights violations. In fact, colonizers may claim this psychological suffering to be accidental. The webinar today is called Colonized Minds, which alludes to the fact that this psychological suffering and or trauma is not accidental, but incredibly intentional. Can you speak to the strategy of psychological colonization? For example, how have you observed psychological colonization? Can you define this for us? And is this an effective strategy used by colonizers, including and especially in the case of Israel and Palestine? Dr. Samah, do you want to get us started?
Yeah, thank you very much for hosting this event and having me. And it's a pleasure to see WEM again. We had some previous collaboration at Bir Zeit University. And I'm happy to respond to your questions. And I will avoid conceptual definitions and talk about experience. I think the trauma caused by occupation and colonization is deliberate. It is strategic. It can be presented as accidental or collateral damage, but I think it is part of the strategy in order to deter people, in order to maintain the occupation and colonization. And this has been the case all over the years of occupation and military violence used against Palestinians. But now we see a peak in instrumentalizing trauma against Palestinians. I think the aim of the excessive bombardment that we are witnessing in Gaza is not only to deter Palestinians, but to deter other people in the region from daring to oppose and stand up to Israel. The other observation is the huge damage to the health system and to infrastructure, which will inflict further death on Palestinians. So this excessive and repetitive killing of Palestinians through bombardment, which renders people to mere statistics, and with the destruction of the health system and the prevention of the reproduction of Palestinians. You know, for so long, Israelis have described Palestinian fertility and reproductivity as a demographical bomb. And we see that the destruction of the health system is also making a huge impact on women and preventing the normal reproduction of Palestinians. But also starvation has been weaponized. So there are different methods that are being used to shock and traumatize Palestinians and kill them. And those who survive the killing are usually frozen from trauma. The level of trauma is so severe. We have seen things that we never witnessed before. We saw cadavers, corpses of people being eaten by dogs and cats. We saw people being, their bodies being taken by bulldozers. People were found in mass graves with eyes blindfolded and handcuffed. They were executed and killed alive. So the images are so shocking that they are capable of freezing people psychologically. And I think that this is one of the strategies that are used by the colonization, by the occupation, to fix people in paralysis so that they will not dare change the situation. They will not dare to challenge the status quo. And back to the title, the occupied mind. I think also, if you asked me this question a year ago, before October the 7th, I would talk about the stealing the time of Palestinians, putting Palestinians, the denial, the excessive denial that Israel is using, and forcing the Palestinians to make the effort to prove their narrative. For example, they kill Shirin Abu Akleh, and they deny that she was killed by a soldier. And then Palestinians have to make the huge effort and investment in order to prove their narrative. So when we talked about the occupied mind, we always have to exert excessive energy, huge energy, to counteract all the obstacles that are imposed on us by the occupation. And then with the little left over from our energy and lifetime, we try to live. So there is even in the absence of direct and huge political violence, an occupied person, a person living under a military occupation and colonization, is depleted in so many ways.
I can maybe pick up on this point, but just a small correction. I'm an assistant professor at Bursa University and a fellow with the Ashraf Space Center. So I'm primarily based at Bursa. But I think some of those points are really important to think about and to also take into consideration. As a lot of people in the audience know, that we've been witnessing 9 months of genocide in Gaza, but there's also been a 76-year history of various forms of erasure, colonization, occupation, and all of that. And I think the question about intentionality is really important, because oftentimes, and what we've seen over and over, especially even if we're just thinking about Gaza, like, this isn't the first war, this has been an exceptional genocide in so many ways, but there have been multiple wars on Gaza and offensives on Gaza, specifically since 2008, and then also the ongoing siege since 2007, that are really, aimed to kind of deplete people, to really wear people down. And so you have that mix of kind of like the direct violence that we're seeing. But I think also what we're seeing right now as red lines that we thought would not be crossed, that have been crossed not once, not twice, not even 10 or 20 times. And you see, like, if we take, for example, the attack on Al-Ahli Hospital very early on and the genocide, and Dr. Hassan Abu Sittah, like, made note of this, that this was a way for Israel to basically test what it can get away with. And then since then, we've seen almost every single hospital attacked, and all the time with the same excuse, without that burden of proof being on the Israeli military to actually prove their claims. And I think this speaks to Samah's point about the level of dehumanization that the Palestinians have to take it upon themselves to prove their narrative, to prove you can't make a claim without then having multiple references and multiple sources. And even if you look at the variations in terms of how the media, especially within the US context, and people have done this on social media a lot, but where they compare sort of titles in terms of where Israeli claims are taken as fact, Palestinians' claims are always kind of presented as being, somebody's perspective or perception, but not really having that same weight or factual accuracy. But then most of the time, what we do find out with all these investigations is that what Palestinians were saying from the beginning were actually very accurate. And I don't think we can read the situation without seeing this as being intentional, especially in terms of the impact that it's supposed to have on psyche. If we are thinking even just in terms of the kinds of killing that have been happening within this genocide, like, it hasn't even been enough to actually then kill people. Like, there's been, a fragmenting of bodies. Dr. Nader Shalhoub-Kavarkan refers to the concept of ashla, or, like, I'm not really sure what the best translation for it is in English, but, like, even people's bodies are not. Recently, we've also been hearing testimonies from people in Gaza that are talking about, when they think about death and the possibility that they will be killed, one of their hopes is that their bodies will be whole and not broken up into fragments. Because, and we've seen different, I think a lot of us have seen these images. And I don't think we can really read that as being unintentional or accidental in a way. And I think it is meant to break people's spirits, to make them think that you have to be complacent with the situation, that if you try to resist, it will be like this or even worse. And I think this also then raises questions about, and for a lot of people, it's also just made a lot more clear the hypocrisy of the international system and the application of rule of law, especially within the US context and how the US have continued to protect Israel from any sort of accountability.
I think something that you kind of started off with is contextualizing this violence and this genocide within a long period of time. And that takes me to kind of the next question that I had, which is for both of you, of the past 9 months of genocide are obviously just a small fraction of the history of colonization and ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And you've described for us kind of like the current situation of mental health in Gaza and beyond. But can you contextualize this within the past 76 years since the Nakba? Like, how has mental health of Palestinians changed over these 76 years? And have there been shifts over time?
So maybe I will start talking about the distress and the violence of every day. And I will touch upon certain things that are experienced by most Palestinians. One of them is the geographical fragmentation and checkpoints. Checkpoints can be a very difficult experience. It's not only a place where people get arrested often, but also it consumes so much of our time and energy. When I see laborers, university students, school students sometimes crossing checkpoints every day, it's a very depleting experience. No Palestinians has not been affected by this experience, and checkpoints and separation wall, they have separated fragmented families. If you are a person from Jerusalem, for example, and you get married to a person from the West Bank, you will have two homes, you will meet on the weekends, there will be family problems. And sometimes we receive a child from that family in the clinic suffering from anxiety or depression. And in the background, there is the story that my mom is from Jerusalem and my father is from the West Bank. And we live a double life. We pay very expensive rents here and there. So that's one element that is very commonly, very prevalent in the Palestinian experience. The other experience that is also common is political detention. 20%, I'm talking about statistics before, from 67 until last year, before October the 7th, 20% of the Palestinian population have experienced political detention, and torture and maltreatment are commonplace when people are politically detained. But after October the 7th, there are 10,000 people who experience political detention. So there is an escalation in this experience, and the level of torture and treatment is becoming something unprecedented. I have been working with victims of torture for 20 years, all through my presence here and work in psychiatry in Palestine, 19, 20 years. But now I listen to accounts that at the beginning when I listened to these accounts in November and December, I didn't believe them. And then when we started hearing them from many people who don't know each other, that was a proof for their credibility. For example, in the past, we know that people get blindfolded only when they are arrested until they reach interrogation place. The first man who came to me and told me that he was blindfolded for 28 days all the time and handshackled, I didn't believe him. Of course, I didn't argue with him, but I thought that no, it wouldn't happen. Then I started hearing this from many people. So I don't want to talk about other details that can be chilling and they will provoke the sensibilities of people, but political detention and torture, which are done according to military law, is an experience that is very intimidating to the Palestinian society. Especially when it happens to our youngsters, it injects guilt in their families, in their parents. So this is very difficult. And then the political violence kills people in the West Bank and Jerusalem almost every day. Not with the same intensity like what we observe now in Gaza. But I think what's happening in Gaza creates an anticipatory trauma of genocide here in the West Bank. I talked previously and wrote about a new presentation that I see in my clinic that I call disordered eating, not eating disorder. I received a few young people who stopped eating, who couldn't eat. They say that they have stomach ache or a feeling of disgust or something stuck in their throat that prevents them from eating. And when we elaborate and talk more about this, they connect that with the images that they see from Gaza, with the inability of people from Gaza to eat. Some of them, they say, because we heard that, like, my father is in prison, and I heard that prisoners don't eat. So what's happening in Gaza is affecting people everywhere, Palestinians everywhere, not only in Jerusalem and the West Bank. I have to say, because you asked a question about mental health, we managed, our health system is modest but effective. In the West Bank, we have 14 community mental health centers that provide the public service in every district. We had 6 in Gaza. We have 1 psychiatric hospital in the West Bank and 1 in Gaza. We provide community mental health interventions in collaboration with schools, with NGOs, providing psychosocial support. We have trained our doctors and nurses to integrate mental health in primary health care. Now, this system is still working in the West Bank. It is affected because part of the punishment of Palestinians is that there are cuts in our salaries. The Palestinian Authority has not been receiving the tax money from the Israelis. So it's not functioning fully, and people don't receive their salaries, but they continue to work. In Gaza, there is a complete collapse of the system, but colleagues try to find a way to help others. And maybe later I can talk a little bit more about it.
So I'm not a clinician on the Tzemach, so I think that Tzemach's insights on this are really important. I would just like to maybe go back to the point of that Tzemach started with, like, talking about distrust. And I think especially when we're thinking about mental health more broadly and psychosocial health, it is important to think about just kind of the everyday and, like, mundane effects of colonization and occupation and what that does to people. And this is something that a lot of us have been thinking about, like, including Dr. Sanah and, like, Dr. Aditala Kamal and others. But also just thinking about sort of the social suffering that's constantly associated with it. And the fragmentation is something that has been really important. And despite, like, you know, if you look at the map, the West Bank seems to be very close geographically to Gaza. And it is, like, if there were no checkpoints and restrictions, it would only be about an hour to an hour and a half drive, for example, from Ramallah. But for example, like, if I'm speaking about myself, like, the last time I was able to go to Gaza was in 1996 when I was a child visiting my aunt. So it's, you know, almost easier to travel to another country than it is to see certain parts of your homeland or to see relatives. And I think one of the things that we've kind of seen over time is through the different phases and I think processes of both occupation and colonization is this further fragmentation of people. And when I think it's also important to think about that in the context of the way that people usually are like used to think and talk about mental health within the context that there's a very strong sense of the collective and the role of the collective in helping people be steadfast or in helping smooth. Like if you look at all those active things that people used to do, it was a very communal thing. And what we've seen through different phases is a lot of the different strategies and tactics used by the Israeli occupation has like intentionally tried to break up that, whether it's like by geographically separating people, by creating also from the beginning different identity card systems that differentiate. Even within the same family, you might have people who hold different types of IDs and then have different restrictions and need to live in different places, like Samah was referring to. But then it becomes over time, and I think over time, when you have sort of a weakening of some of these collective processes because you don't really have the same ability to get together, we've also been seeing that to an extent. So I think it's really important. Just the examples that Dr. Samah mentioned is about like disordered eating or like the way that people kind of relate to what's happening in Gaza. But one of the other things that I've noticed also in conversations with people is that there's this, and I think even in my own experience, is that there is this constant tension and contradiction that you feel inside. Like you do feel guilty on the one hand, if you do have food on your table or access to water, even with all the restrictions and everything that comes with it. And then it also just feels like there are fewer spaces where you can then try to do things and be active in a way. And I think this connects to this idea of paralysis and political paralysis that have really been affecting people, because I think it's hard enough facing the everyday sort of features of occupation and the structural violence that a lot of us do live with on a daily basis and sometimes have to normalize in some ways. But I think, because I remember, especially in the beginning months, the paralysis around that was just extremely difficult. And I think people do try to find ways of being active, of trying to at least play a more active role in like getting information out there and trying to connect with people who are there on the ground, trying to, take part in donation drives or everything else. But I think it is really important to actually think about that within that fragmentation and what that does over time and what that does to the collective. And maybe I guess I'll take the opportunity to kind of pose the question to Dr. Smith. It's like, what is the role of the collective right now, and how do you see that as being as affecting kind of people's mental health and well-being in this moment as well?
That's a very important question. I think the harsh reality is aiming to force people to mind their personal survival and to disconnect from the collective. Because if you're connected with the collective, you receive some of that collective punishment that is touching everybody. And I think the collective traumatic experience requires collective therapy, collective intervention, collective healing. The way I perceive, I will continue this conversation of mental health services. Let's not be deceived. I don't think that we can, with our modest mental health apparatus, meet the need of the people. I think we need to think differently of mental health and the mental health of Palestinians. And the way I think of it now is that, of course, there are some sick people who need to be treated through the conventional ways by psychiatrists and specialized mental health professionals. I think we have a vast majority of people who experience psychological pain, which is different than psychological disorders, psychological distress. They are wounded by what's happening. And I think that wounded people can organically heal. We need to be facilitators of that healing, making sure that they get the necessary support in this organic healing process. So, and I think that what we observe in Gaza is unprecedented. All the in Palestine for a while, we've been expecting crisis, and we have an idea of how to manage when we have small-scale crisis. People are trained to provide psychological first aid and some of the kits of WHO that are suitable for humanitarian interventions. But this is unprecedented, and these tools are not appropriate. So we need to be modest and observe what people do to help themselves in Gaza and learn from that and try to provide interventions that are similar to their needs, to their initiatives, that in a way try to resemble the organic efforts that they initiate to help themselves. And I want to give a recent example that I've been involved in thinking of it. We observed that children in Gaza like kites. Children of Palestine like kites. If we have some Palestinians in the audience, if you remember the song of Marcel Khalifa, "Tifl wa Tayara," the boy and the kite, which creates this juxtaposition of the kite and the flight that throws bombs on villages, and the poem of Al-Arair, which also brings the metaphor of a kite and the long string that will connect the boy with the love of his lost father. So the metaphor of kite is important for Palestinians. We are designing an intervention that uses kites with children to let them express themselves in play, in agency, in making the flight themselves. It requires meticulous composition of things, but it gives people a sense of agency. They will do it collectively. So that's an important element for the steadfastness and the smooth of people. They will fly it. They will draw things or write letters on it. The flight can reach to certain geographies that they cannot reach beyond the checkpoint. It can connect them with the lost ones. We call this intervention as healing through skies. I think that these kind of interventions are appropriate to the Palestinian situation. So for a while, I've been questioning the adaptability of imported Western approaches in therapy to the Palestinian situation. That was before the genocide time. Now with the genocide time, of course, we cannot put every Palestinian on therapy chair. We need to augment, we need to expand collective interventions for bereaved mothers, for mothers of people who have disappeared and they don't know their fate, for people who experience torture, for children, for certain professional groups like rescue people who participated in getting the corpse out of the rubble, for doctors and journalists. That should be the approach that is suitable for the situation. Another important thing is perceiving advocacy and awareness and witnessing and accompaniment and telling the story of the Palestinian people who cannot tell their own story. That's a role that mental health professionals should play in this very difficult time. For a while, we feel, you spoke about paralysis and helplessness a few times, Wiam, and I think that was the first, like many people felt like that at the beginning. Among mental health professionals, many people feel that their tools and their contribution is not suitable for the time being. I think we need to shift gears and play roles that we have not played before. And advocacy, witnessing, accompaniment are very, very important elements of our role as health professionals and as mental health professionals.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if there, but there was a question also from the audience about how useful do you think then concepts like trauma, like as a category, is to the Palestinian setting, especially given that Palestinians have to prove their narratives to fit a trauma narrative. In
the concept of trauma, that's the question, is about the concept of trauma.
Yeah,
you know, I think.
Yeah, the question is, how useful do you find it?
I think the DSM definition of trauma does not encompass all the painful and damaging Palestinian experiences. So trauma, as defined by the DSM-5, talks about the integrity, the physical integrity, and the threat or the damage to your physical integrity and sexual violence. But if I burn your olive groves, or demolish your home, or spit at you and humiliate you, or I take you as a captive in Israeli detention, and I wouldn't give you sanitary pads unless you dance with the Israeli flag, that is not considered to be traumatic according to the DSM-5. So it ignores many painful and damaging experiences by Palestinians. And if you can only think of the categories of the DSM, what would be the diagnosis? Adjustment disorder? What would be the diagnosis for people who experience such symptoms? And I think the current situation have forced me to theorize, to rethink of many of the definitions that are used in Western psychiatry, and to theorize alternative ways of thinking of the current need of Palestinians. Also, the WHO definition of mental health, which talks about individual mental health, it talks about people achieving their potential, their productivity. Well, you can be a healthy person living in Gaza, but you don't have any job because there are things outside yourself that are preventing you from being productive. It doesn't mean that you are not healthy. So if you want to apply the WHO definition of mental health, this means that no healthy people are in Palestine. We don't have healthy people in Palestine. So I think we need to come up with our own conceptualizations that match with our experience. And we need to acknowledge the obstacles outside the self that impair our well-being. I don't ignore that people have their inner causes for suffering. I don't ignore that people have internal processes, but the processes outside your mind are overwhelming and excessively damaging that we cannot understand everything as if it is happening in your mind and assume that with individual therapy and medications, we can fix the suffering of the Palestinians. And those who tend to easily pathologize Palestinians and suggest that they need humanitarian aid and individual therapy and EMDR and medications, maybe this is a defense because they don't want to acknowledge the political reality. So they want to avoid the political question. So it's easier for them to overemphasize and to over-visibilize the mental illness of Palestinians. And we need to be careful about that. And we need to always point to the horrible circumstances that bring a lot of suffering. And also in these situations, we, again, because you spoke a lot about helplessness and paralysis, that's the goal of trauma. It's to impose paralysis. One of the definitions of trauma is that it is the disaster of paralysis. And I think that anyone who tries to find agency within themselves to try to do something about this situation, even if they don't change the situation, but the fact that they are trying to do something, they are trying to resist, is helpful by itself. Like in Gaza now, we see unprecedented horrors, but we see also people who go to find the corpse and try to give them respectable barrier. We see doctors who work relentlessly. We see doctors who come out of Israeli detention, out of torture, and on the second day they go to work. So traumatic situation can damage many people, but it can also energize some people. And what we see in Gaza is more than what we expect of people who are energized and determined to not be broken and not be forced into helplessness in reaction to all the horrors that are being imposed on them. People, I think it is because people understand the tactic of the genocide and the tactic of colonization and political subjugation. And they try to resist it because they understand that it aims to pushing them into a point of paralysis and helplessness.
Yeah, I think that speaks to a lot of the questions that we've been getting from the audience as well. And one kind of question to follow up on that, I really appreciated your point about kind of the idea of like humanitarian aid. And I can see already in my mind, a future in which perhaps humanitarian aid groups send therapists and medications and pills to go treat Palestinians. And I'm wondering kind of, first, I think you spoke to how maybe that might not be effective, but I want to know perhaps, is there a different approach that you would call for? What would you say to those NGOs, organizations that might, their first instinct might be to send therapists and pills? What would you like to see instead? And maybe you don't have an answer, but yeah.
Well, we welcome anyone who wants to help, but there are certain conditions. I think institutions that have avoided any political statement, any ethical position on genocide, thank you, we don't need your help. Stay where you are. Second, anyone who wants to come to help, they need to be sensitive to the Palestinian culture. Those who mock Palestinian religious values, those who want to avoid the word shaheed because it is very terrifying for them, those who have an Islamophobic influence, deal with your phobia before you come to Palestine or stay where you are. For those who want to come and help, we want them to be sensitive to our political plight, acknowledging, validating. We accept any questions about the culture, willing to share with them and to orient them to the Palestinian sensitivities, and willing to collaborate with them as equal partners. But if they want to come with a snobby attitude, with a background of Islamophobia and racism, with a depoliticizing attitude for what's taking place, we don't need you, really. We don't need them. They will do more harm than good to Palestinians. If they want to come here, they will learn Palestine, I think that it's a very troubled place. It's a very modest, the health system, mental health system is very modest, but it's a place where they can learn a lot. It's a place that can teach people a lot about running health services and mental health services in the midst of agony and genocide. And anyone who's interested, really, I personally will collaborate and I will encourage many colleagues and many mental health institutions in Palestine to collaborate with them.
Maybe on that note, and I think looking through some of these questions, are there any examples, and this is summarizing a few questions, but are there examples of more culturally sensitive approaches or interventions trying to that address mental health?
Well, it's just listen to the people.
Particularly,
I didn't hear the last thing. So you're talking about cultural approaches to mental health in Palestine?
No, there are questions about whether there are like culturally sensitive and effective approaches to mental health that could be applied in the Palestinian setting, or that you think would be appropriate for the Palestinian setting.
If we want to take a modest position and just listen to what people say when they come out of a traumatic event, they will bring different names of God. They will say statements like "La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah," "Hasbunallah," "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Those are statements that show how much people rely on their belief. That they believe in Allah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. It means that to God we belong, and to Him we shall return. Meaning that they know that they will meet the lost ones in a different life. If people believe so, whether we agree or not, we have to strengthen that belief. We don't need to impose it on those who don't believe, but we need to accept that people believe so, and we should treat them with respect and avoid mocking them and calling them fatalists. Look in a pejorative way to their belief system. Palestinians are proud of their sumud. They like a lot to talk about their sumud. But the word sumud comes from one of the names of God, Samud. It has a religious connotation, but it is used by religious and non-religious. Samud in Arabic language, in old Arabic literature, is the one that we can rely on. It's called Samad. And God's name, As-Samad, is the most Samad, is the one that we can rely on the most. Will not be affected by difficult conditions. Who's reliable. He's the ultimate refuge. So the word Sumud, which is inspired by or connected to this word, is important to Palestinians. And I think when we don't want to answer this situation by medicalizing people, let us observe how people help themselves and build on that, encourage that, as far as it does not impede the well-being of individuals or seeking other pathways of help when they need it. So they come with their organic ways, we offer our ways, and we accept their freedom of choice.
I think that's
the collective aspect is very important as well. Sorry, you want to say something?
I think that's a really important point, because oftentimes, in a lot of portrayals of like a faith and religiosity within some contexts, it's seen to be fatalistic rather than driving people to Asians. But I think you were also mentioning from Ghazda Sraz at this point that people's faith really drives them to actually do and act and persevere, rather than being something that actually then stifles them or stops them from carrying on in various ways.
And I think also two more important elements for the survival of Palestinians in this difficult time is justice seeking and solidarity, international solidarity. And I think Palestinians they want to export their sumud to the world, but they want to receive international solidarity. International solidarity is validating. It acknowledges the pains of people. It stops them from the feeling of isolation, from the possibility of doubting themselves. We observed over the past couple of days the speech at the Congress that was cheering for someone who's wanted by the International Court, the International Criminal Court. He spoke against solidarity and the influential people in power were cheering his words in a spectacular way. And I tell you that this can do a lot of harm, psychological harm, to Palestinians. And at the same time, the international solidarity, who tries to stand up for this fabrication, for this hypocrisy, can give a lot of moralization and support to Palestinians in difficult times.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on something that we haven't quite touched on a little bit quite yet. And I know we're running up on time in the next 10 minutes. So I think I've heard you speak a lot about the pathologization of experiences of mental distress. And I came across a quote recently online that said, Hannah says she prefers death to displacement, that she cannot imagine leaving, that her home is her soul. And I was struck by this. It was written December 23rd, 2023, by a Palestinian writer from Gaza. And it, I think, for us in the West, can be the immediate instinct to immediately pathologize this experience and say she is suicidal or she has lost her mind. How do you conceptualize of this experience, specifically the experience of preferring death over displacement?
Displacement has been worse than death for our fathers and grandfathers. People feel that it is it's like permanent humiliation for Palestinians. And some people are willing to die in the perseverance of to preserve their dignity. Displacement is morally and psychologically annihilating for many Palestinians. And in fact, we saw that's not only a rhetoric. We saw people trying to go to their homes in the north of Gaza. They were shot at checkpoints. And we saw many people who stayed in North Gaza and they died due to starvation. So people are not only saying these things, they are acting according to these words. But we see also people on hunger strike being called suicidal. When Palestinians participated in the March of Return, the Grand March of Return, they were called suicidal by international media. Children who, young people who participate in demonstrations, they are called defiant and perverse. There are also, I remember a statement that was posted on the social media of Avichai Adrai, the spokesman of Israeli army, who said that women who participated in demonstrations, they lack femininity and honor. They lack femininity and honor. So that's also another way to incite the Palestinian society against those women who lack honor. And to play on the sensitivities of the Palestinian society. So accusing people of or pathologizing people is another way to take credibility from them. So Palestinians, for the minds of Israelis and their Western allies, are either terrorists or sick. They are not rational people, and they have no reason to ask for sovereignty or to hope for freedom. And international solidarity was also touched. They were called Iran's idiots. So the IQ people in who participate in protests was judged by the guy who's wanted by the International Criminal Court as idiots. That's also a way to take credibility from them. He said something like they scored F not only in geography but in history or something like that.
I have maybe one last question before we do an outro, which is, a question we received from the audience even before this webinar started, which is how does this colonization impact the diasporic Palestinians all over the world? We've talked a lot about Palestinians who are currently in Gaza or in Palestine are impacted, but what about the diaspora?
For diaspora people, re-traumatization of the trauma that exists in their genes, in their memory, in their unconscious, in the attachment style with their parents. So there is possibility that they will be re-traumatized and vicarious trauma. And by the way, you don't need to be a Palestinian or an Arab or a Muslim to be traumatized to have vicarious trauma for what's taking place in Palestine. If you are not a corrupted human being, if you have a good sense of empathy, justice, and you are connected, you have any social contracts with humanity, you can be traumatized by what's happening in Gaza. And by the fact that the word "let it happen," soon it will be 300 days. And by the fact that international law and human rights don't apply to everyone on earth, they apply only to those who sign it and who can judge it by their Western institutions, but not to everybody. So that is traumatizing. That is, it breaks, it damages the fabric of our common humanity. It damages our belief in a better world, in human rights, in international law. And it is very dangerous. This is very dangerous. And if those who perpetuate a genocide in Gaza get away with it, why wouldn't any tyrants in the world just replicate it and make it in a different part of the world? That's why we should continue challenging world hegemony and a world order that is dominated by one pole. And the shame that we observed in the American Congress 2 days ago, this should be challenged, and we shall not give.
Thank you. And maybe, well, do you have something to say, kind of to end, take us all to the end?
Thanks. No, I'm going to touch on that point, and I think you're also touching on the point of moving forward. And like what's, you know, even thinking about the diaspora and all this stuff. So on the one hand, there, what we see is this constant, like, you know, war against solidarity, against activists in the US, for example, like we saw the reactions to the encampments. Samah Hossa mentioned how that was even portrayed in that despicable speech in Congress. But I think it also just kind of makes it all the more important just how important our collective solidarities are and just connecting with other people. And I think especially for a lot of people within and outside of Palestine and what regardless of whether they're Palestinian or not, and I think trying to create spaces where we can connect with each other and push each other, because like Samah Hossa mentioned, it's like sometimes you start to wonder whether you're actually crazy in a way. And we know that we're not, and we know that we are standing on the right, on the side of justice, and ultimately that's what we're working towards. But at the same time, I think we do need to acknowledge that because it stands against what the power that be want there to be, it's going to be an uphill battle, but it's also a really important battle that we need to, you know, all work together for, rather than isolate ourselves and. So I think it's a really important point to actually reach out and try to build a collective rather than focusing on individual forms of healing.
Amazing. And we have 1 minute left, and I just want to say thank you so much, both of you. Thanks. for sharing all of your wisdom with us. And I'll just say that this webinar was organized by the Harvard Graduate Students Union Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Caucus. And if you didn't know, we're a group of student workers who came together to call out Harvard's complicity in Israeli apartheid and occupation. We stand in solidarity with Palestinian workers, workers against apartheid, and workers against occupation. As part of our political education programming, we have been organizing various webinars. Previous webinars can be found on our YouTube channel. Our future events will include a webinar, and it'll be happening in August. So keep with Gaza Sunbirds. So keep an eye out for our Instagram account at HGSUBDS, and we'll see you guys in August. So thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, that was a conversation with Dr. Samah and Dr. Hamouda. It was entitled "Occupied Minds: The Impact of Colonialism on Palestinian Mental Health." Unfortunately, we are out of time. But please, if you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, you really need to subscribe to the podcast for the show notes and for the extra content. I'm hoping to add some additional bonus episodes that only appear on the pod in the future as well. In case you're wondering, this special music you're hearing now is The Boy and the Kite. That was a song by Marcel Khalifa that Dr. Samah mentioned. I want to thank HGSUBDS so, so much for sponsoring her and Dr. Hamouda for this very important talk. It takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Stan Robertson and Bob Funk. With additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed El-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. عجناح الطيارة والسما الجلة أسرار حد يتلو أسرار فرفح قلبه طار عجناح الطيارة والسما الجلة أسرار حد يتلو أسرار وقف بالساحة ينده رفقاته والهدير تحول لدخان كبير ومدري شو صار ودق النفير والطيارة الحاملة قصص وأشعار شعلت الأرض وهدمت الدار وهدمت الدار وهدمت الدار وطارت لحدود حدود الولدني برق ورعود بتقصف عالدني وطارت اللعبة وطارت معها القصة صاروا الولاد شقف من القصة
طارت لحدود حدود الولدني برق ورعود بتقصف عالدني وطارت اللعبة وطارت معها القصة صاروا الولاد شقف من القصة والقصة مكتوبة عصطيحات الضياع والضياع الهيوبة والعتمة مثل الشمع والقصة مكتوبة عصطيحات الضياع والضياع الهيوبة والعتمة مثل الشمع والشمع بتضوي والصرخة بتضوي والشمع بتضوي والصرخة بتضوي